The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition this week. Jim is meeting with us, or recording with me, remotely, so he'll sound distant again like normal. His phone microphone isn't as nice as our studio microphones, so that's why he sounds a little bit different again this week. And I think this week he received an email from someone that we decided to turn into an EDU show. Talks a little bit about the, I think the summary is it's kind of the benefits of proper asset positioning when you're approaching or in retirement to weather storms like we're experiencing right now. So, Jim, can you hear me okay?
I can. Can you hear me?
I can. So we can proceed.
Perfect. And thanks for the little disclosure to our listeners. We are not. We are practicing social distancing, as they say. And Chris is in the office upstairs, germing it all up. And I am actually in my home calling from the phone again. But we're going to keep trying to do this to just do our little part, as they say, in this battle against the virus. But the virus kind of has to do with the discussion today. We received an email not too long ago, a few days ago, that really hit home. And as I read through the email, and I know you've received this email too, Chris, it was from a podcast listener who kind of took a lot of what Chris and I are trying to get you do-it-yourselfers to think of as you're planning your retirement. But he shares how he originally, Chris, I don't know if you have the email in front of you, he originally was with the more traditional firms, the AUM probability statistic firms. You have a 90% chance of success. And he switched and started positioning assets and looking at his retirement in the manner that we encourage people to look at. And he just kind of shared with us how he's reacting in light of everything that's happening. He's a new retiree, and how he's concerned, but he feels not nearly as concerned as he would have been under one of the more traditional approaches to retirement. I just thought it was a good, and I think you agree, Chris, first-hand experience, if you will, from someone who is trying to look at retirement differently than the way all the big firms want you to look at it. That here is a probability, as long as nothing bad happens, you might be okay. And Chris, I know that's always a thorn in your side too, and you always point out, what if that 5 or 10 or 15% chance that things don't go right happen? Anything you want to add on that? Because that's kind of what people are experiencing right now.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. One, if you're following a traditional approach, or you know people who have retired that aren't following kind of the style of retirement planning that we profess, they might be very upset right now, especially if they just recently retired. Maybe imagine retiring earlier this year and then facing all this market turmoil. And you call your investment advisor who said you had, you know, a 95% chance of success or whatever the number might have been. And you might have called them, and then they're telling you, don't worry, you still have a 95% chance of success. So there's a possibility that your chances of succeeding in retirement haven't changed that much. But what this doesn't address is the emotional reaction to the market turmoil. So that emotional reaction is going to change your behavior. And while statistically they might try to profess to you or convince you that everything is fine, that this will pass, and that there isn't permanent harm being done to your situation, watching your assets go through a crazy turmoil like this can be very emotional, and then you might decide not to do something you were planning to do. Now, of course, things are restricted now for health reasons, doing or not doing some of the fun things typically people would do. But we don't think you should have to do that, or we don't think you should react like that in your early years of retirement, because that's when you're young enough for you know, to have the ability to do these things that you've been saving money for this whole time. The other thing I want to point out is the people interested in this show, of course, are those who are either approaching retirement or maybe retired not too long ago. And while if you're a 30 or 40 year old, you may not be that upset by this situation. This is, you know, in a long-term investment horizon, this is just one of those episodes that happens, like in 2008 and in 2000 and, you know, back before the 91, you know, there's just kind of recurring market turmoil for a variety of reasons that we've seen. And if you've got 20, 30, 40 years left in your investing horizon, or before you're going to retire, not, you know, it's, people don't get as worked up, but you have to think about, if you're not already, how are you going to react if you're at the end of your work life, that paycheck is no longer coming in, and now you're starting to draw money out. And watching your investments spiral up and down violently, obviously down is what people are mostly concerned about, but watching that happen, even if statistically you seem to be still okay, can change your behavior in a way that would be very unfortunate. So that's why we propose a different approach to this, an approach that will provide you a little bit more control over your near-term life as far as your spending goes. And it's all about positioning of assets appropriately for your spending intent. That's really what the positioning piece of our recommendations usually entail. So that's what I wanted to add, Jim.
Excellent. And what we mean by positioning, which longtime podcast listeners will know this is a new term that I've adopted, we used to call it bucketing. And I'm getting away from bucketing. Bucketing is a concept we like. We're getting away from the verbiage bucketing. We still like the concept of bucketing. But what it is just trying to divide your money up into separate pools and get them positioned to be consumed. That's how we used to view what is called bucketing. And the reason I called it bucketing is it was a good visual, Chris. You've got one bucket for the money you're going to spend the first 2, 3, 4, 5 years of retirement. We used to call that bucket one, and we'd encourage people to have that in cash or cash-like holdings. Now you can see why. If you knew your first 2, 3, 4, 5 years of money was in cash and cash-like holdings, you don't necessarily have to alter your life right now. And you still may not like seeing your portfolio be volatile, but you know, okay, my spending for the next X amount of years is protected. And we would tell our clients and our podcast listeners how much you put in what we used to call bucket one, but how much you put in cash and cash-like should be dependent on how emotional you are to losses, how much money you have, how adamant it is you want to spend this money. So we would encourage clients anywhere between 2 and 5 years in cash. And I think you would agree, Chris, the vast majority of people chose 3. And I think it's only because it's kind of in the middle between 2 and 5.
Yeah, and this is where it might sound like we're doing the same thing as a more traditional investment advisor might recommend, that later in life you should position, you should have a certain amount in cash. Where our process differs, and where we encourage you to adopt our process if you're trying to mimic what we do as a do-it-yourselfer, is to let the amount of cash that you have in this, what used to be called bucket one, I don't know what we're going to, I guess we'll call it position one or whatever you want to call it now, Jim, but this bucket one should be determined by your spending intent. What you actually are going to spend. It shouldn't be some arbitrary, gee, our studies show that as a 64-year-old, you should have about 20% of your assets in cash. This is, again, one of those lazy approaches where they take averages or typicals due to some study somewhere or some academic that decided, gee, it'd be reasonable for a 64-year-old to have this kind of asset allocation. It has nothing, it should have nothing to do with your age. This is something you won't hear and haven't been hearing for decades from the typical retirement planning crowd. It shouldn't have anything to do with, now, it happens to be, a lot of this recommendation happens to coincide with people getting older, so it might appear to have something to do with age. It really has something to do with how fast you intend to spend it, when you intend to spend it, how much you have, what are your other resources that are not investment assets, things like Social Security, pensions, income annuities, if you have any, those types of things. All of that has to be considered to then come up with what we find to be a logical approach to defining how much cash you should have on hand. It should be driven by what Jim just said, 2 to 3 years worth of spending that you intend to make, spending from your assets. You might have some income coming in, right? So this is the net spending above and beyond that. Everybody's situation is going to be different. Not every 64-year-old is going to be the same as every other 64-year-old. Not every 70-year-old is going to be the same as all other 70-year-olds. If they're basing it on your age, they're missing the mark. They're taking the lazy approach.
Absolutely. But it's all about also, folks, getting you to understand the rules that took you to retirement, the rules that you use to accumulate your assets, will not be the same rules that will take you through retirement. They will not be the rules to use when you are spending your assets. And start realizing that. Our approach is to teach you to stop being emotionally attached to your portfolio and not want to spend it, and start doing with it what its intention was, to consume it. It would be the same as a rancher raising cattle and then being so emotionally attached to them, he can't slaughter them. And I talked about how that happened with my neighbor's pig, Mr. Piggy, and how shocked I was and my girlfriend at the time was when Mr. Piggy was now pork chops in his freezer. We became emotionally attached to the pig. Could you imagine being a rancher so emotionally attached to your herd you can't consume it or send it out to be consumed? I'm a gardener. I love to garden. But imagine me being so emotionally attached to my tomatoes that I go out and I don't have the heart to pick them and consume them. We run into people all the time as they enter retirement. They're too paralyzed, Chris, to spend their money. But they're also so steeped in accumulation rules, they didn't put any of this positioning, what we used to call bucketing, but I'm trying to be a little more pragmatic here, it's positioning. They didn't do any positioning, Chris, with their assets. They still got this pool invested, and they think, oh, I'm in a 60-40 portfolio. Well, you're down about 18% right now if you are, barring the volatility we've seen over the last couple of days. But a moderate portfolio is probably down close to 18%. If you were in an aggressive portfolio, you're probably down closer to 23, 24, 25. And if you hadn't positioned any assets to be consumed, you might be panicking now. Well, this podcast isn't going to help you get out of that mess, but it's going to hopefully get you to understand why we believe in positioning, why we don't believe in probability statistic, Monte Carlo directed planning that is generally offered by advisors who are looking to manage your money. So, of course, they take a very investment-centric approach because they are going to charge you a percentage of your assets to manage them. I can't see going through retirement like that. It's archaic to me. And the best way is we want to share with you this email of a listener who was in that group and how he recently positioned And he just wanted to share with us his emotions and what he's thinking and going through. So let me begin with the email, Chris.
Okay.
He says, "Hi, Jim and Chris." Oh, hi, Chris and Jim. Wait a minute.
Oh, perfect.
I'm so used to Jim and Chris.
Maybe
he put your name first.
Maybe he knew my birthday was coming up soon.
Which it is, April 1st. Yeah. Happy birthday. And that's no April Fool's joke. It really is April 1st.
It is.
Well, he put you first. So
perfect.
Clearly, the man's not as intelligent as I thought. No, just joking. Hi, Jim and Chris. Excuse me, I said it again. Hi, Chris and Jim. Listen to your podcast, EDU 2011. Does that mean it's the 11th podcast of 2000?
Of 2020. We're in 2020 now.
What did I say?
2000.
So, oh, yeah. 2020, yes.
Yeah, so
okay,
this year
so
it's the 11th podcast. Yeah. So 11th year, podcast. Year 11, episode 11 is what he's referring to.
Gotcha. Okay. Listen to your podcast, EDU 2011, about virus and retirement planning, and I found it encouraging, and it did prompt me to make a few tweaks to my retirement plan. From what I can determine, and here's where he gets a little funny, and he ties it in at the end of his email as well, folks. But he says, from what I can determine, it is my desire to retire on my 65th birthday that caused this market turmoil, since my birthday was this past weekend. I guess my birthday was the mega version of causing it to rain just after washing your car. And then he ties in later, folks, if you're wondering why he wrote that, that 10 years ago when he was 55 and he first started thinking about retirement, we ran into the 2008 market correction. And he's wondering, Chris, every time he thinks about retiring, the market corrects. And he's wondering if that's what's causing it. So anyways, a little bit of humor there. But he goes on to say, the reason for this email is to let you know, following some of your suggestions, I feel saved me $1 million and a lot of stress by following your approach. Now, let me say, I don't know if what he did because of our previous podcasts saved him $1 million, and I want to make one thing clear. Simply losing money in the equity market, I don't want to even word it losing money. Simply being in a bear market does not cause you to lose money. Selling in a bear market causes you to lose money. Your share balance, listener, and listeners in general, has not changed. You have the same number of shares. If you had 1,000 shares of a stock, and that stock happened to be, say, invested in the energy industry, which is taking it on the chin in all this, or the airline industry, or the travel industry, and it lost 50% of its value, you still have the same 1,000 shares. And depending on when you sell that, that will determine if you lost money or not. Please recognize that. We've had a few conversations with people recently who keep saying they've lost. And I keep telling them, you haven't lost anything. Your biggest mistake is you thought, looking at your statement and that money that the statement said you had was in fact what you had. A statement is just a snapshot in time of what you would have had if you sold on the day that statement was produced. By time you get the statement or look at it, if you're looking at a statement a year old or a month old or a week old, it's what you would have had a week ago, a month ago, a year ago if you sold. And if your money isn't needed for another 10, 20 years, if that positioned money isn't needed into the future, you haven't lost anything yet. Emotionally, you've lost, but you've got the same number of shares. But what matters, Chris, is the day you sell the asset, is it not?
Totally. It doesn't become real, if you will. Now, the value of the asset certainly goes up and down. That's real. But what you actually have to go spend, that money you have invested in whatever it might be, isn't available to you yet until you sell it. When you sell it, turn it into cash, that's what you're going to then go spend on a vacation or paying your electric bill or whatever you're going to decide to spend it on. That amount that's available for spending is determined by when you sell it.
Exactly. So if you've only positioned or built 1 year's worth of spending or needs in cash, you might be panicking because you're faced with, goodness, I'm going to have to free up some more money next year. And if you are trying to cover expenses that are very fixed and I guess you could say rational, what we call your minimum dignity floor, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care, they are fixed, methodical, ongoing expenses. If you are trying to cover those expenses by debiting a volatile asset, equities, you're going about it all wrong. You have not matched the correct liability, a fixed methodical liability, with the correct asset, a very volatile, price-changing asset. You have a dichotomy, is that the word I'm looking for, Chris? A difference there?
Just a disconnect.
A disconnect, yeah. Thank you. You have a disconnect there between a fixed asset, folks, and a fixed expense and a volatile asset to cover it. And yes, now you might be forced to have to sell in a down market. But if you're not being forced to sell, if the money in your portfolio that's down is money that you have positioned to be spent 10, 15, 20 years from now, what we've called bucket three, if you will. We're getting away from the verbiage bucketing. I'm calling it positioning. But you can still position your assets in what we used to call bucket three or crazy uncle. We would try to get our clients to talk about their investments as crazy uncle. So psychologically, they're preparing themselves that this portfolio could go up or down. It's crazy. But if that is the money that's down for this listener, if it was money that he was going to spend in 15, 20 years, I can't say he saved $1 million or not. But if he's talking about money that he was going to consume in a year or two or three, and he's looking at what it used to be invested in and what it is in now, yes, perhaps he did save that. Because if your short-term money was to lose 20, 30, 40, 50%, you now have to cut an expense, Chris, and or sell more of a down asset, which causes your portfolio to run out of money quicker. And what we don't want you to do is have to cut the fun things you want to do early in retirement, when you still have the health inclination and desire to do so because the market is down. So anyways, anything you want to add about his positioning and his assertion or belief that he might have saved $1 million by doing this?
No. Nope.
Okay. So he then writes this, Chris, of where he used to be and how he just changed. He said, in 2017, I started to refine my do-it-yourself retirement plan. The guy's a do-it-yourselfer like you all listening. In 2017, I started to refine my do-it-yourself retirement plan after leaving, and I don't want to mention this firm that he left. The firm is a national firm. If I mentioned it, you would recognize the name. The reason I don't want to mention them, they're not here to defend themselves. Hey, this guy's wrong. Here's what we were actually doing. So I'm not going to name the firm, but it is a national, Chris, if you will, brokerage and insurance type firm. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay. After dumping XYZ firm, I don't want to name it, after 20 years with them, I left them for a variety of reasons, but in retrospect, the reason should have been a total lack of retirement and income planning skills. Now, I want to pause there and say we often see that, do we not, Chris, that a lot of planners who are out there might be good in one aspect, but they try to do things that they're not well skilled in. And retirement planning, in our opinion, is a separate skill set.
It is. It's a skill set or an area of financial planning that most everyone is going to run into, right? Almost everyone is going to have a retirement phase. Not everyone will do all the other elements of financial planning, like estate planning and investment planning and education planning, and all the list goes on and on. We focus on the retirement planning side, but sometimes someone in one of those other disciplines that's really good at, say, investment management advice, accumulation planning, decides they'll dabble a little bit in one of the other areas only to find out that they're in way over their head, or they really, maybe they, honestly, what I've run into with a lot of the folks, obviously the most common financial planner slash advisor, whatever label you want to put on them out in the world, are the investment advisors. They're thick as thieves. They're everywhere, right? They're everywhere. Investment advisors. So there's lots of those with that, you know, variable levels of skill in that area, but there's a lot of them out there. Well, when you're in that area and decide to dabble in one of the others, I see a lot of them not even knowing what they don't know. They don't even realize that they're not giving very comprehensive or useful advice to people because they don't even know what they don't know. Now, there's some that are excellent, that have bridged the gap, that have went out and educated themselves and learned all of the intricacies of retirement planning and distribution planning and how to deal with Social Security and taxes in retirement and all the rules around their retirement accounts. And they're, you know, on and on and on and on and on, lots of stuff to learn in the retirement planning space. And kudos to them that they took the effort to do that, and maybe they've morphed themselves into both an excellent investment advisor or wealth advisor and an excellent retirement planner. Those are few and far between, I'll tell you. And so I encourage people to get an expert in the area that you're interested in receiving advice. Go to an expert that focuses on that. They might also, you know, you might get advice from others on other areas. It's going to be very difficult to find one person or even one company that provides all areas of financial planning to an equal degree of expertise, if you will. I'm not saying they're not out there, but talk about a unicorn if you were to find one. I haven't seen one yet, but I will admit they could possibly exist. But this is typical of the big investment houses. Their focus is that, 90% on that. And then they do a little bit of other stuff on the side because clients were asking them after they were with them for 20 plus years, they're approaching retirement age, they would like some retirement planning advice. So who do they talk to? Who they viewed over the past 20 years as the financial expert in their lives that was giving them advice for a fee, or, you know, advice for a charge of some kind. They don't do it for free, right? And logically, you would go to them for advice. They are loath to send you somewhere else. They're afraid you're going to go somewhere else, get advice that might cause you to move your money away from them, and then they can't continue to charge you fees. So almost never do they say, oh, you've now moved into the retirement phase. We're really good at the accumulation phase. You should go find a specialized retirement planner for your help in this area. There are very few that have the moral character to do that. Or may not even, like I said, my original point, they don't even know what they don't know. They don't realize the benefit that a true focused retirement planner could bring to their clients, so they don't refer them out. They think they're doing them a good service. They don't even know where they're lacking.
I agree with both of those points. So this listener continues. After he fired that national firm, he interviewed another national firm, and he writes, I did find the personal service and level of professionalism at, and once again, I'm not going to name this firm. It is a national firm, Chris, that concentrates more on planning than most national firms. I'll give this firm that much. I will also say I respect the founder of this firm immensely, but I disagree vehemently with his approach to retirement planning. And they are an AUM-style firm, Chris. They want to manage assets, and then they'll throw financial planning in there. So anyways, I'm not going to name the firm, but it is a national firm, and I have nothing personally against the founder. I just disagree with their approach. Okay. I did find the personal service and professionalism at ABC Finance, I don't want to name them, attractive, including how they included my wife, who hates all this dollar and cent stuff. And that's very important, folks. I'm going to pause there again. If you're interviewing planners, make sure, because we often see this, Chris, and it's not necessarily the husband that's always the active one. A lot of people that we've chatted with, the wife is the active one in the finances. But it's very typical to see one spouse more involved than the other. Sometimes we see both spouses equally involved, but more often than not, one is very involved, the other isn't. Make sure whatever firm you're working with does try to involve the non-involved spouse as much as they want to be involved. I've dealt with some non-involved spouses who just don't want to be involved with it. Hey, Jim, thanks for reaching out, but so-and-so will handle that, not me. There's others who then have thanked us to at least involve them. We get it. Not everybody is into this. But it's important that the non-involved spouse listeners, if you're listening to this and your spouse isn't, the non-involved spouse needs to know what you're doing. You need to leave very detailed instructions or make sure they know that if something happened to you, get a hold of this firm, and they will be able to help you. So it's very important, even if you have a non-involved spouse, you involve them even without their explicit participation, but they're being involved in the planning process.
It's also a reason to keep whatever plan you put together straightforward and simple to follow. Because even if you leave super detailed instructions, if they weren't particularly involved, they may not really understand all the moving parts, and you might be leaving them way too intricate of a puzzle to solve than is needed or warranted or that they can handle. So this kind of coincides with our approach, which is keep it as simple as possible. Don't make it any more complex than it has to be. There oftentimes has to be some level of complexity. These are our lives we're dealing with here and plans in the future and making decisions. But there are very hard to follow plans and very straightforward plans. I would get as close to straightforward as possible.
Exactly. Okay. Their plan for us, remember, this is the firm that he started interviewing after firing the national firm that he was with, which was more of a broker-driven, insurance-backed firm. Then he started interviewing what he thought were planning firms. And he said, their plan for us, 2 years before we retired and 5 years into our retirement, was a Monte Carlo-driven plan, resulting in a diversified portfolio of 70% stocks, 30% bonds, and they encouraged us to take on and carry a very large mortgage through retirement. The founder of this firm, he is huge on carrying mortgages into retirement, and I don't agree with that at all. But anyways, he continues to write, I did not sign up for their approach, but mostly due to their assets under management pricing model. In other words, they wanted him to move the money, and they were going to charge a certain percent of assets on the money, and that's the only way you could get a plan with them. That's what mostly, the way I interpret that paragraph he wrote, Chris, that's the main reason he didn't hire them, although he was hesitant with the Monte Carlo and 70% in equities, but and 30% in bonds, but it was ultimately the pricing model that turned him away. He said, however, I did follow their recommendation into the start of 2018 on my own, maintaining the 70-30 mix stocks to bonds. But in time, I decided this approach doesn't fit or didn't fit my risk profile. He said, in 2018, I started listening to your podcast and liked your model for analysis. Between your podcast and Wade Fowle's Safe Retirement, we speak all the time about Professor Wade Fowle. What school is he at again, Chris? I forget. Is he American College?
He's at the American College.
Mm-hmm. Okay. He's Wade Fowle is highly respected in the retirement planning field. He may think a little more favorably. He would not, let's just put it this way, have liked the series of podcasts we recently did on how I don't like using IUL to fund retirement. He's actually more of a proponent of that approach than we are. But outside of that, Professor Fowle and I probably see eye to eye on a lot. So he writes, between our podcast and Professor Fowle's Safe Retirement approach, I found a direction for my portfolio that suited my needs. And over the coming months, which required unlearning all the accumulation habits I had for growing my assets, I had to start teaching myself to shift into a spending aspect and look at my portfolio as deferred income. I like how he started approaching that. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I think, first of all, he recognized that the Monte Carlo approach didn't really fit. He was uncomfortable with it. He also
Can you explain what that approach is so people who don't know what we're talking about know?
Sure, sure. This is it's an approach where they look at, they simulate the future by running a bunch of hypothetical scenarios where your portfolio returns are a whole bunch of different randomized returns, trying to simulate what would happen to your portfolio over time, given the level of spending that you want to do. And they keep it real simple almost always, where they have some constant level of spending that only adjusts for inflation. So they don't recognize more spending in one year than another year. They just say it's all flat. But then what they do is they apply a random series of returns to your portfolio that are supposed to mimic the possible returns of the market based on market historical returns. And they run a whole bunch of scenarios, usually 1,000 or more of these scenarios in their software, and they record how many times out of 1,000 the portfolio runs out of money before you pass away or before a certain date in the future. And they come back and tell you a confidence level. They say work 95% confident you will succeed, which sounds great, right? 95% sounds like an A. But what they're admitting to you is 5% of our scenarios, it failed. You ran out of money before you passed away. And so what they don't usually ever focus on is what exactly will your life look like if you run out of money, which is going to happen in their, you know, in their statistics, 5 out of 100 times. So out of 100 of their clients, 5 of them are going to face this, essentially, is what they're telling you, with a 5% chance of failure. So you'll get a number out of there, and it's called Monte Carlo because it's based on randomized, it's a gaming theory kind of a approach. That's where Monte Carlo comes in. So instead of putting in a fixed predicted yearly return, they actually try to simulate the volatility and variability and randomness of actual returns using a random number generator that generates returns, and then they run the scenario over and over and over and over again. So that's kind of a summary of how that approach works.
Excellent. And for those who want to know, the scenarios are called iterations in Monte Carlo world. So you'll often hear a Monte Carlo advisor say, I ran 500 or 1,000 or 10,000 iterations. Iteration just simply is how many different scenarios they're running. The key is what Chris picked up on. They are trying to, with this approach, fund a, to us, your minimum dignity floor, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care, are non-negotiable, must cover no matter what expenses. They are fixed in the sense they're always occurring. They're not fixed in their value. The cost of them rise throughout your retirement because of inflation, but they are fixed. They are methodical, and they have to be covered. And Monte Carlo attempts to cover those expenses with a very variable and volatile asset, a portfolio. And that's where Chris and I disagree vehemently. The other thing I want to point out...
Not with each other, with that approach.
The other thing I want to point out, Chris, you were a little too generous in the sense you said 5% chance of failure, 95% chance of success. One of the topics that I follow sometimes on the financial planning forums that Chris and I will read are advisors who are asking, what is the level you are willing to accept? And I've had seen rather some posts where advisors have written 80, 85 is acceptable to them.
Wow.
And I would think, really? You're going to sit there to a client and say, hey, you have an 80, 85% chance of success and that somehow is good? I would never do that. And that is the other reason Chris and I don't believe in it. What if you are that 5, 10, 15, 20% that's not going to work out? I like how you worded it, Chris. Even at 95%, that means five of this advisor's clients out of every 100 are not going to make it. But imagine if your advisor is considering an 80, 85% Monte Carlo chance of success acceptable. Maybe it's acceptable to him or her, but is it acceptable to you, truly? This is why we just don't believe in funding fixed, methodical expenses with a volatile and variable asset, because you can't cut food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. You can massage them. You don't have to eat fancy food. You can go to eating cheap food, if you can even find food at the grocery store now. So you might be able to reduce your minimum dignity floor expenses a little. You don't have to leave your house at 70 degrees in the winter. You can lower it to 65 or 60. But do you want to? Do you want to be 80, 85 years old, having to turn down the thermostat? So that's why Chris and I believe in matching the liability to the proper asset. And to us, your fixed, methodical, minimum dignity floor liabilities need to be matched to fixed, methodical, lifetime guaranteed income, Social Security, pension, and income annuities, and not left to some asset manager who I feel Monte Carlo, I always said this, Monte Carlo was a way for asset managers to continue to manage money when you were supposed to be spending it. Because they marry Monte Carlo to what, Chris? A safe withdrawal rate, which is usually 3, 4%. Used to be 4. Now it's probably closer to 3. Why? And again, maybe I'm totally off base here and I'm going to upset some of our financial planning or investment advisory listeners. I think a lot of it, though, Chris, was designed to maintain their assets under management. If they limit how much you spend, it puts more money in their pocket.
Well, it increases that likelihood of the plan succeeding, too. They start running it, and they start adjusting some of those the constraints of the randomized returns. If the failure rates start to go up, one of the things you can do?
Spend less.
Reduce the drawdown of the portfolio by restricting the safe withdrawal rate, and then magically you go from 80, 85% up to 95% likelihood. Well, what did they just tell you to do? Cut your lifestyle. Cut your lifestyle to make this work, not position things to make this work. I would propose it's better to try to adjust what your tools you have rather than adjust what you plan to do with those tools.
I agree totally. And that's what Chris and I try to get people to understand. But not only that, folks, there's only so much you can cut. There's only so much you can cut. And that's one of the reasons I don't believe in carrying the mortgage into retirement. But I don't want to go down that road. But anyways, let me continue with his email. So then he said, my portfolio switched from the 70% equities, 30% bonds with a very large mortgage to what now amounts to a 30% equity, 70% cash and bonds with a fully paid off mortgage. My assets are actually allocated in a bucketing strategy where I have seen my minimum dignity floor. He must be a longtime listener. He knows our logo, lingo. My minimum dignity floor is covered. My minimum dignity floor delay gap is covered. Before I proceed on, what is that, Chris? He's a longtime listener to know the words we use. What's the minimum dignity floor delay gap that he has fully covered with cash?
So the...
And keep in mind, he's 65, so it gives you an idea right. What he's positioning.
Okay, so the first thing we always look at is the long-term coverage of your minimum dignity floor. Long-term meaning most of the years of your retirement until presumed mortality. So that is going to be the years where you have all of your secure income turned on, like your Social Security, pensions, any income annuities you might have. But for a lot of people, it's just Social Security is their secure income source. And we look at that, and for some people, that they might be covered or they might take steps to cover that. That's step one. Step two, though, is looking at the years prior to the Social Security or other income sources turning on fully. For a lot of reasons, we have people that delay claiming Social Security till 70. Usually it's because they want to cover their minimum dignity floor the most substantial way. And the way to do that long term is to create the largest Social Security benefit you can. But for a 65-year-old, that means they've got 5 years before maybe they're turning on the last bit of their Social Security. Maybe their spouse turns it on earlier, but it's not full throttle until age 70. So there's a delay gap, a delay period where the only reason you actually have non-covered minimum dignity floor is because you've chosen for your own benefit to delay turning on one of your secure income sources, usually Social Security. So that delay period, we're not worried about covering it with secure income because, one, you're at the beginning of retirement, you have the assets, and we know how long it lasts. It ends at 70. The problem for the other part and why we use income to cover minimum dignity floor after that is that we don't know how long after 70 you're going to live. If we knew, then we could strategically deploy assets and not have to worry so much about secure income. But because your length of life is unknown, that's why we treat that differently than the 5 year in this particular listener's situation. The 65 to 70 year old period is the delay. So what he's said in here, to interpret what he mentioned, he's taken assets and set them aside so that they're there, and because it's for something so important, minimum dignity floor, and it's happening very soon, so it couldn't handle a market decline, he's positioned the first 5 years of his minimum dignity floor in something super safe. My guess is in cash or cash-like assets.
Perfect. And then he goes on, Chris. So he definitely is following a lot of what we espouse on this podcast. He says, I have reserved dollars for my long-term care. So I'm guessing he's going to try to self-fund. I'm a little hesitant on that. We're going to do a show on that in the future. We've received a few emails recently on that, Chris. So we'll probably do an EDU shows on that. But for now, he's self-funding his LTC. I've reserved dollars for my long-term care. I've established a buffer. Before I go on, what does he mean by a buffer? Because we espouse that.
It's a stuff a little extra aside just in case our projections are wrong. And when I say our, I'm you if you're doing your own projections, or us if we're doing projections. As much attention as we try to pay to our projections and assumed inflation rates and how we think you're going to behave in retirement and how your housing situation and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes things change. First of all, things can end up different than we decided, or you might decide to make a change. Maybe at 75, you decide to up and move to wherever your kids live or something like that, and that wasn't in the original plan. The buffer is meant to cover things we haven't considered in the base plan. Just extra protection, a little extra cushion that you've got set off to the side. So if something comes up and you need it, you draw it back. Now, you can access it. If you get later in life and your life is kind of settled and there's not really any substantial chance of a surprise thing happening, it's not like the buffer gets set aside and then definitely gets handed off to your kids. the buffer you might use to spend later on, or maybe give as gifts to kids so they can enjoy while you're, you know, there's things you can do with it before you pass. But when you're 65, probably a good idea to have a little cushion off to the side for the just in case.
And then he writes, and my go-go years, which I feel will be the first 8 to 10 years of retirement, I have reserved my fund spending in U.S. treasuries. So let me stop there and just tell you guys what he did, truly, I feel, Chris, is he kind of followed that five-part series we came out with, I think, in January or February.
And he approached it pretty darn conservatively if he's got 8 to 10 years in treasuries.
Does write, now I don't have to be concerned with the money that I have left in stocks because those dollars are not going to be needed for at least 10 or more years. So he's not worried now about his investments, which should be 100% equities. Follow our logic here, listeners. Bucketing, or what we now call positioning. This is what this man did, folks. He positioned his assets to be spent. He stopped thinking like an accumulation planner that it's all about returns. Oh my God, you're going to be out of the equity markets. You can't do that. You're going to give up returns. You could grow your portfolio more. That BS crap works great if you're 30 or 20 or 40 and you're still got 30 years to retirement. It doesn't work in retirement, but also it treats your assets as an investment and not what they truly are, deferred spending. That's what it is. It is no longer an asset. It's money that is going to be spent. And if you don't spend it, someone else will. So what he did is he positioned, and in his case, maybe he was a little conservative, but he moved 70% of his assets in different positioning. The money that he was going to need during the delay period to cover his minimum dignity floor, he put in cash. Then he looked at the long-term care. He wants to self-fund it. That had to have taken $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000. So he would have moved that money. I don't know into what, he didn't say. We tell people who are going to try to self-fund, you should try to look for about a 3.8 to 4.3 expected return. That would be about a conservative portfolio. So I'm not sure how he allocated that. Then he positioned money for his fund spending, and that he put in treasuries, and he protected 8 to 10 years of fund money. And then he built a buffer. I don't know, again, what he put the buffer money in. But that left about 30% of his money, which should have been invested 100% in equities. You don't have to take that and invest it moderately. I would go at maybe not 100%. You could go 90-10. And the 10 might be more high-yield bonds instead of treasuries. In other words, if you've got all this other money, but positioning is just visualized asset allocation, folks. So he's just positioning his cash, his fixed income, and he's telling himself, this money is for long-term care. I'm not spending it. This money is a buffer. This money is the money I'm going to spend on minimum dignity floor while I'm waiting for my secure income to turn on, and this is my fun money. And clearly, Chris, he wanted to protect his go-go phase, which is what we advocate, the phase of life where you have the health, inclination, and desire to spend on fun, and he didn't want to cut any of it, so he put it in very safe treasuries. Now, we see that. Now, some people will put some money in the equity market, some fund money, and we're okay with that, folks. Why? Fund spending is variable, so it can be covered with an asset that's variable. But minimum dignity floor is fixed, and it should not be covered with an asset that's variable. If his fund money had fallen 20, 25, 30%, he could cut his fund spending, could he not, Chris?
Or he could change his plan and say, okay, I realize that's happened. I now need to decide, am I going to cut what I'm doing now, or am I just going to say, well, I'm going to keep my current spending, but realize I might, unless things improve and things come back, I might be in a position where I have to drastically cut my later in life fund spending. He has to face it like that and realize that he might be forced to do that. He has to make a decision now how he's going to approach it. You can't make those kinds of decisions with your heat bill and your insurance payments and the minimum dignity floor, but the fun stuff you can. Now, if you want to prevent yourself from having to worry about that decision, you take his approach, which is to put 8 to 10 years super safe and in treasuries in this particular case, and then he doesn't have to be facing those kinds of trade-offs, but he has taken a very conservative approach to his overall positioning. And that's the nice thing about our plan. Our approach is there's not just one way of doing it. There's a lot of room for variation here. You can follow our approach and tend to be a little bit more on the none of our approach is aggressive overall. I would say it's you could be less conservative or more conservative depending on what makes you feel good about your situation and your intent. He has covered everything. Not everybody sets aside money for everything. He's actually very, very well positioned for protection. His fund spending for 8 to 10 years, not everyone will build it so rock solid like it appears he has. But it is one way to follow our approach, yeah.
So he continues. The net result is my assets today still hover. The net result is my assets still hover around the 4 million mark today. If I had followed with, and again, he names the firm, but we're going to call it the ABC firm, the firm that wanted him in the Monte Carlo 70-30 model with a very big mortgage. He said, had I followed through with the ABC financial plan, my assets, according to my estimates, would be about $3 million today, and I'd still be carrying a massive $350,000 mortgage. Hence my assertion that following this strategy resulted in a $1 million savings. Again, one could argue if it actually would have turned out to that or not, but that's what he wrote. So the result now is every time the market drops 10%, my overall portfolio drops about 3%, which is still not fun, but it is not stressful. And I have comfort knowing all my expenses are covered between age 65 and 75. And then he writes, still not used to the dollar number. I'm still not used to the dollar number of $100,000 in a day. I don't know what he means by that. Do you? Let me repeat it. He says, I'm still not used to the dollar number of $100,000 in a day. Oh, maybe because the market was losing. Remember when it was losing 10% in a day? So he would have lost $100,000 in a day. I think that's what he's referencing, that big, massive drop the stock market had.
Yeah, so he's not used to that, seeing that. That's not typical, right? So that is kind of surprising to people. But he then remembers he's got his first 10 years positioned where he doesn't have to be affected directly by that.
The key, and we're going to wrap up now, folks, because Chris has a call and I have a call coming up. The key that we want you to understand, retirement planning shouldn't be a worry. And a lot of people make it a worry because they enter retirement wrong. They have the wrong plan. You are trying to use the rules that took you to retirement, and you're trying to use those rules to go through retirement. The sad thing is, as Chris mentioned, a lot of investment advisors who also want to be financial planners take what they know best, and they may know investing, better than Chris and I. That's why we hired a chartered financial analyst who works at our firm. He knows investments better than Chris and I, but we know planning better than him. But you have a lot of investment advisors who know or think they know or maybe truly do know investing, and they're good at growing your assets, but they're loath to see those assets walk out the door when you retire. So they're going to offer retirement planning, and they're going to use software that's quick and easy. And that's Monte Carlo. And they're going to just teach you what they know, and they know accumulation. So they're going to try to apply accumulation rules to a distribution portfolio using probability statistics. And we just feel that's not a reasonable approach. And we feel that way for a variety of reasons, not just because what's happening right now, but a number of reasons, least of which, and Chris already alluded to it, as you age, your ability to understand complex financial topics will diminish. Why do you want to leave the 75, 80, 85, 90-year-old you a very complex retirement plan built on iterations, probability statistics, withdrawals, rebalancing? Gosh, why not just have steady lifetime guaranteed income, Social Security pension, and yes, the godforsaken four-letter word, income annuity? Why not just have enough income coming in to take care of your minimum dignity floor of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care? So no matter what happens, you have pooled that risk into an income stream you cannot outlive. If you don't do it that way and you try to do it through Monte Carlo and withdrawal statistics, what happens? You take the risk on yourself. There's no risk pooling. And if it fails, what happens, Chris?
You fail. There's no backup to it. If you're taking it all upon yourself, then you might fail. You might also successfully succeed, and I'm putting that in air quotes. What we didn't even talk about, you can listen to other shows where we've talked about the weaknesses of Monte Carlo. What they also don't tell you is there's a small chance that you end up with a ton of money when you pass away. There's hopefully a small chance you run out, but if the gods are smiling upon you over the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years of retirement and the returns favor your portfolio over that time period, you die with a whole bunch. Now, they can't tell you spend more because of that potential, because then it increases the likelihood that you run out. So that's what they're focusing on. But in our world, that's also a failure, specifically in mine. I don't think Jim's as offended by it maybe as I am. But I'm offended when you're showing someone a plan where they might end up with $10 million when they pass away. Oh, my gosh. Unless that was their direct intent, my goal is to leave $10 million for my kids to spend. You've just done them a great disservice by putting them in something where they're going to end up with a whole bunch of extra money in some possible chance, right? And think of all the things they could have done to improve their lives while they were alive instead of restricting their spending to maintain the probability of failure in something supposedly acceptable in the 5% range or something like that.
Absolutely. I want to apologize if you heard my water bottle fall. Did you hear that?
I did. I think everyone did, yeah.
I figured everybody heard that. I am home in my kitchen and my water bottle fell. Fortunately, I had the cap on it, so it didn't spill. But I hope you guys got a little bit out of this listener's email. I liked it because here's someone who left the AUM Monte Carlo probability-driven world, a do-it-yourselfer, who is doing it his way, that way, because that's the way he always thought it needed to be, and instead started positioning assets to be spent. That's what retirement is, folks. Right here in my house right now, you all can't see it, Chris can't see it, I have two grow trays growing. Three tiers each, four trays on one, three trays on the other, all with seedlings that are going to be moved out into my garden. And I'm going to coddle them and grow, but then harvest what I'm doing. stop looking at your portfolio as an oak tree that's going to sit there forever, that's going to be something that you can pound your chest and be proud of yourself to growing, and start looking at it what it is. It's just a really big vegetable garden. And now it's time to consume it. So position your assets to be consumed, because if you don't, and you run into an issue like we are today, you know, Chris, they all call this, they being, again, the Monte Carlo advisors, they call what we're experiencing a black swan event. And they're going to tell you, God, we never saw that coming. We always figured there'd be a typical recession that we would be in, but nobody saw coronavirus.
Yeah, well, guess what? Even though we don't know the name of each black swan that shows up, we know that they do show up periodically.
And they show up a lot more often than the tales of Monte Carlo assume. The tales, we're getting way too deep. I don't want to get too far into it. It's more of a bell curve, and we're talking a tail event. But what I'm getting at is, yes, maybe we won't see another virus like this for another 100 years, because that's kind of how long it's been. Maybe it'll be another 100 years before there's a housing blow up. Maybe it'll be another 100 years before terrorists attack the United States on our own soil. The three major black swan events that have happened over the last 20 years. But there'll be another black swan event, Chris. Maybe the individual black swan events happen very rarely, but a black swan event itself is not that rare. And it's going to happen. There'll be something else that we can't even begin to imagine that will blow up the markets in another 8, 10, 12, 15 years, and they'll call it a black swan event. Nobody saw it coming. So keep that in mind. These events happen with regularity, just that the events are different. You're always going to have a black swan event. It's just going to be something different that's causing it. And what we're trying to get you to do is start looking at your assets as deferred spending and line them up, queue them up.
No, we want you to look at it as deferred spending.
Pardon?
We want them to look at it as deferred spending.
Did I say not to look at it as deferred spending?
It's okay.
Oh, well, that was a stupid thing to say. I shouldn't have said it that way. Thank you for listen to what I mean.
I didn't want to leave people with the very last comment, the opposite.
Listen to what I mean, not what I say. Remember the one we recorded just a few days ago? Oh, God, that show was painful. It took me forever to explain something.
A little rough, but we need to take off because I need to get
Yeah, you have to get
call,
going.
So.
Okay, anyways, folks. Hopefully you learned a little, or at least we got you to look at your retirement a little differently. Chris is going to wrap everything up, and I will see you all next week. Stay safe, and we'll be in touch.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks.
And thanks to everybody who's listened. We're going to try our best to continue to do these shows every single week. If you don't mind hearing Jim calling in, I think it's still understandable. Doesn't sound quite as nice, but... we appreciate everybody who listens. If you have any questions, please send them in to us at jimhelps.com. We'll try to handle them on our Q&A show. Or if you have a topic you think would be good for an EDU show like today, we'd be happy to consider that as well. So we'll be back with you next week with another brand new show.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.